How's it going, everybody? Brian Alvarez here on Figure Four Daily. It is August 6, 2013, here at figure4online.com/WrestlingObserver.com. We are joined today by Joey Ryan, world traveler, most recently seen in TNA and about to head to PWG for their anniversary show, which is taking place this Friday. And Joey, how you doing?
I'm doing well. How about you?
Not too bad. Are you excited to head back to PWG?
I'm very excited. Those are always great shows, and they're one of my favorites to do.
Now, when you've been all over the place, you've been with Ring of Honor, you've been with TNA, obviously PWG, as everybody knows. Do you feel that when you meet people, when you talk to people, that you're best known for your PWG work?
A lot of people know that. A lot of people, oddly enough, remember Wrestling Society X.
Yeah.
Yeah, so probably PWG or Wrestling Society X. And in LA, sometimes I get recognized for Lucha Vavoom, but that's obviously like a local product.
Do you get recognized more for Wrestling Society X than for TNA?
That's a tough one. I mean, Wrestling Society X is so far removed now. Nowadays I find more of my interest or more people that get a hold of me on the internet or Twitter or whatever, Facebook, know me from TNA. But over the years, definitely more people than you would think know me from Wrestling Society X.
It's just funny because Rob Van Dam has talked in the past about how when he was with TNA on television every single week, he would always have people coming up to him and saying, "Why aren't you wrestling anymore?" And it was always kind of funny to me because it's not like nobody watches TNA. You know what I mean? They got like 1.5 million viewers virtually every single solitary week. Yet,
right.
I don't even know who those people are because you always hear from these guys. They're like, nobody knows I'm wrestling even though I'm on TV every week.
Yeah, I mean, they definitely have their solid fan base that watches them every week. But again, like, as much as I do get recognized for TNA stuff with, fans on the internet now. A lot of them, I haven't been on TV in such a long time, and a lot of them, still hit me up like, "Hey, you're great on Impact." And I'm like, I haven't been on Impact in such a long time already. I mean, it's been months now, and people don't know that I'm not there still, So it's kind of weird how, I don't know if it's wrestling fans just, they don't watch it or they kind of follow it, but, maybe their core audience isn't so much a wrestling fan or the online wrestling fan.
I think that with TNA, as somebody that watches it every week, they seem to have this deal where they will rotate people on and off the show, probably to save money. And so sometimes it'll be like, I just realized I have not seen Velvet Sky for 4 weeks because they rotated her off television. And I think they rotated D-Von off like right after he won the TV title on pay-per-view. So he won the TV title and then he wasn't seen for a full month. And so I think fans have kind of gotten into they've gotten used to the fact that guys just kind of disappear for a while and then come back. So there could be a lot of fans that just are expecting you to come back anytime.
Right. That's true. That's true. That's fair.
Do you, I guess, let's talk a little bit about TNA. We obviously didn't talk about that the last time you were on this show because you hadn't debuted. You did the gut check, and I'm sure you've done a million interviews about it, but just as kind of a capsule explanation, what happened with gut check? How did they contact you, and what was the process of doing this gut check?
I got selected. Well, I got pretty much David Lagana was who got me on. I worked with him in Ring of Honor and in NWA Hollywood, and he got me on Rinka King, the India project. And he's very familiar with my work, and they were looking for guys for gut check, and he pitched me to Al Snow and showed footage, and Al liked it, so Al called me up and just said, "Hey, we're doing this thing, gut check." They'd only done one previous to me. I was the second ever one. And, so he kind of explained the concept to me and then said, "Would you be interested?" And I said, "Sure." And so he's like, "All right, we'll send you flight info." And it was literally the week before I went. So there wasn't, a whole lot of thought or deliberation to it. And then, I went and had my match with Austin Aries. And, luckily I got to wrestle Austin Aries and, so I got to show a little bit of what I could do. The very positive reception backstage from the producers and agents who liked my character and liked my work. Derek Bischoff and Hulk Hogan especially. And so I think because they had given Alex Silva the first contract, which
accidentally
was well, you know, it's speculated that it's accidental. I don't know what Ric Flair's thought process was, but, you know, so they gave him the contract. So the thought process then was that, you know, like I was being brought in, and I kind of had a feeling that I was being brought in to be a no, or like, you know, just kind of like a, you know, cause they can't give a contract to everybody or else the whole thing looks, you know, loses credibility. So I think I, was supposed to be a no, but like, the producers liked me so much. And like I said, Eric Bischoff, Hulk Hogan liked me. So, you know, I think they went along with the no, and I don't know what, you know, what actual deliberation that like Taz and Bruce Pritchard and also like, and, you know, I never really got privy to that situation, but, so I think they were still going to go along with the plan for no, but luckily the day of, you know, that I did had my, you know, went in front of the judges, they, you know, like I had Bischoff and Hogan come up to me and like other producers just being like, hey, so, you know, if it doesn't work out today, we really like you and we want to, you know, maybe do something with you in the future. So like they're kind of hinting at that I was going to get a no, but not to get down because they like me. But I think for gut check, they had to say no. So when I had that in mind, I said, well, you know, this is the only time I get to be on TV, and it was live TV, you know, very not as produced as you'd think it would be for, you know, for being live TV. You know, they're handing me a microphone and pretty much giving me the chance to say whatever I want. I just had that attitude. You know, if this is only 3 minutes I get on TV for a long time, I'm going to make most of it, and I'm not going to, if they tell me no, I'm not going to just tuck my tail between my legs and say, you know, thanks, guys, see you later. I'm going to let them know, you know, I'm going to express my 12 years of being on the indies frustration. And that was it. And, you know, and my, one of the key points of that was like right before I went out too, Eric Bischoff pulled me aside and he said, I understand you're pretty good with a microphone. And I said, I'm okay. You know, and he said, don't be afraid to speak your mind. And that kind of gave me the go ahead to like, you know, that I wasn't going to get heated, that they weren't going to be upset if I did speak my mind. So I did that and I did the segment and I got in Taz's face and I did the whole thing. And, you know, when I got to the back, you know, I thought maybe, like, I knew Taz was upset because I could see it, you know, like, being in the ring, I could feel the tension, but I didn't know who else would be upset, and you know, because, like I said, it was unscripted. It was just, you know, for live TV, here you go, here's a microphone to you, to an unsigned guy. So, like, I think that's kind of what they wanted was, like, something that was, you know, not planned or, you know, just out of the box. And, you know, after it was done and Eric Bischoff himself came up to me and said, that was great. That was what live TV is supposed to be. That was such a, you know, we felt the emotion, this and that. And he was just kept going and going. And he's like, we'll definitely be in touch. And so I said, okay. And then the very next day, actually, when I got home from my flight, I got a call from Bruce Pritchard offering me a contract. So that's kind of how gut check went for me.
Now, was there an incident with Al Snow, or was that internet story?
As far as
getting yelled at by Al Snow in the back.
See, like they have this thing at TNA where they, you know, they try to do, it's really weird because they kind of do these like backstage camera work shoot kind of things.
Yeah.
And so when I got backstage, they had the backstage camera going and, you know, Al got in my face and started yelling at me. And like, at that point I didn't know if Al was legitimately, you know, upset or, you know, about this, how the segment went or if he was playing up to the camera that was right in front of our faces. So I just kind of went along with that. And, so that's as far as, you know, me and Al having a conversation backstage is there was cameras on. So it might've been partly performing, but at the time I didn't know.
It's just kind of funny because it's like, I don't know. When you talk to people from Gut Check, it's like everybody kind of knows what it is, but they also don't really know what it is. It's kind of like it's, and I don't know. It just seems like it would kind of breed some problems. Like, what if Al was really mad at you, but you don't know? You know what I mean? Because how would you know? Because I got a camera right there, and they're not telling you anything. And so now you're yelling at Al Snow. So now he's really pissed off, but he doesn't know that you're not really. You know what I mean? He doesn't know you're not really being disrespectful. It's just the whole thing is weird.
It, you know what? Surprisingly, like I said, it was very unproduced for being on live TV and for me not being with the company. You know, like, it just felt like, wow, they're just really just handing me this microphone. I could literally do whatever I want with it on live TV, you know? And so it kind of, like, it's surprisingly unproduced is the best way I can put it is just, you know, just here, go, do your thing, you know, which was shocking to me.
So obviously you were hired. And when you returned, Taz obviously is still there. Al Snow is still there. Was there ever tension at that point, or was it just kind of like, all right, well, we're all employees now. We're all friends.
You know, initially Taz was pretty upset, and I think rightfully so, because I was kind of burying his work and, you know, his wrestling in his face, and he's, you know, he's proud of it, and he didn't know who I was. He had no idea where I came from, whatever, and I was just disrespecting him in the ring. So obviously there's a little tension there. Obviously, you know, we had some problems we needed to work out, but he came around and he eventually realized that I was just kind of saying whatever I could at that point to make a statement or get a job or whatever. So, you know, it blew over and me and Taz became cool after a while. But there was definitely a little tension between me and Taz because obviously I was disrespecting his work on live TV in his face. So, you know, that blew over. And then, you know, Al and I ended up working together. So, you know, that worked out too.
So that was fine, that whole the Bound for Glory match?
Yeah, that was fine. We just kind of played off what we had been doing on TV. So, you know, we're kind of at that point after the same goal. So, you know, we were on the same page.
Now they put you with Matt Morgan, which was kind of like a very strange pairing. You had a giant lumberjack and then Joey Ryan, you know what I mean? And I never quite figured out what they were trying to do with this tag team. What impression did you get when they put you guys together?
You know, I was all for it. I like Matt and I are friends, and we became better friends teaming. The initial idea was, you know, we were obviously both had issues with the company at the time, and, you know, we were kind of like coming together because, you know, I had problems with the office, he had problems with the office, and, you know, I think the initial pairing made sense, but then I think they kind of didn't really run anywhere with it, which... I don't know if they really thought out like how long we could do that, or what they could do with us. Because, you know, obviously you have Matt who's unstoppable, and then like you have me who, you know, like I actually it probably hurts my character if I'm if I'm not getting beat up all the time. So it kind of was a weird pairing in that sense. I think, you know, a lot of people said, oh, it's like Shawn Michaels and Diesel, but it was very different because like when Shawn Michaels and Diesel teamed, obviously it was about Shawn Michaels and Diesel was his muscle, as opposed to, like, I felt like, you know, me and Matt was more about Matt and protecting Matt, and, you know, like, I would always be the fall guy, and you know what I mean? So, like, after a while doing that, it kind of makes Matt look stupid if he just keeps teaming with me and I just keep losing and losing and losing. So I really don't know if, I mean, I think they had their idea was in the right place. I just don't think they really thought out how or what they would do with us as a team. There was talk at one point of, because, you know, like, we were doing this like kind of tongue in cheek, like backstage, like, you know, it was very like, you know, my heat with the company was kind of based on the internet, and like Matt's heat with the company was kind of based on the internet. And at the time, I think Velvet Sky had a contract dispute going on, and that's why she was off TV for a while. And there was talk of bringing her in with us, but then they ended up bringing her back as a baby face. So I just don't really think that when they put it together, I mean, I think their hearts were in the right spot and their minds were in the right spot. And I just don't think they thought long-term about it. And that's why it kind of fizzled when it did.
Now, it seems that if you watch the show, it seems that there are some storylines that clearly they planned out for a long time. Like, you know, the Claire Lynch thing went very awry when the actress decided that she didn't want to be a part of this anymore. But until that point, you could tell that they had a long planned out storyline involving this Claire Lynch, AJ, and everybody like that. But then there are other storylines where when you watch them, it kind of seems like, okay, maybe they don't have anything planned out. They just kind of are going forward and just kind of doing something with people. Was that the kind of the impression that you got at times?
You know, I never was in any of the producer meetings or any of the writers meetings, so I can't tell you for sure how it goes or what they plan and what they don't plan. I think, you know, they definitely didn't let the talent know very much. And I think they did that to protect themselves because obviously the way it is, if they gave us a script, that, okay, here's the next month of TV, then that next month of TV would be on the internet the next day.
Sure.
Somebody would leak it. So to kind of save themselves from that hassle, they kind of kept the talent in the dark a little bit and they kind of just gave us week to week stuff. So again, not being in the meetings and not having any kind of scripts handed to me, I can't really tell you what's planned out and what's long term and what's being written the week of. But, you know, so I honestly, I can't really answer that question, but, you know, I got the feeling that, you know, they have their storylines that their favorite storylines and some that are kind of, you know, not a priority.
Did you, talk to Hulk Hogan much? I mean, did he give you any kind of advice as far as wrestling, your character or anything like that?
Yeah, actually, Hulk Hogan turned out to be one of my biggest supporters, and you know, he really liked the character, and he would throw ideas at, you know, Hulk Hogan. He was very approachable, and I think you know, he gets kind of a bad rap because obviously people see him, you know, he comes out there and he, you know, he does his on character stuff, and you know, I hear people all the time like, oh, you know, Hogan's not helping the company and this and that, you know, and I understand he's expensive, but he's Hulk Hogan to the company, you know. I don't obviously know the finances of the company, but you know, he's very approachable for anybody, and he's always willing to listen and always willing to give his advice. And he's been successful in wrestling for a very long time. So I thought that was very cool of him that he was so, like, you know, at any time of the day you could find him and, you know, pick his brain if you wanted to. But yeah, he kind of took a liking to me, and like I said, him and Eric were big on me when I was first hired, and so more surreal to me because actually Hulk Hogan's somebody I grew up admiring and was my favorite for a very long time. You know, I ended up kind of being friends with him, which was more surreal than just working with him and doing a promo or backstage vignette with him. Is that, you know, like, you know, whenever we'd be around, you know, or whenever there'd be a show, he'd always come out of his way, or I'd go out of my way. We'd say hi and we'd sit and talk for a minute. And that was very cool. And, you know, like, yeah, I became good friends with Brooke too. And Brooke and I talk all the time, and just, you know, just being friends with them and getting to know them personally was more surreal than just getting to work with them.
Now, another person that of late has gotten a really bad rap, and I don't know, but I feel that maybe this is unfair, is Dixie, who obviously, like, I think 9-10 employees ended up getting cut in like a 3-week period or so. One of them being Jesse Sorensen, and people just, she did her Ask Dixie, and just thousands of people burying Dixie Carter. And the impression that I was given, and this was not from somebody in TNA, so it's not somebody just defending Dixie, but the impression I was given was that Dixie's mom is the one, Janice, that pretty much made the call to make all these cuts because she's kind of handling the finances, and then Dixie just kind of got lambasted for cutting all these people, even though it really wasn't her decision. And I was also told that a lot of people that ended up getting cut got personal calls from her, just kind of apologizing and that sort of thing for what happened. Did you get one of those calls, and what was your impression of Dixie?
I like Dixie a lot. I don't know who makes decisions there and things like that. I didn't get a call from Dixie. I did, you know, Al Snow called me before, you know, and explained it to me and said, like, hey, it's not personal. It's not anything to do with your work. It's just budget cuts, and, you know, the company's, it's more expensive to be on the road, and you know, the company's just trying to set itself in better financial state and this and that. And, you know, he gave me the business reasons why, which is why I didn't really take it personal. It wasn't saying, like, didn't call me and say, like, oh, we hate you, we don't like you, this and that. It's I understand, you know, wrestling's a business. As far as Dixie goes, you know, she's gonna take a lot of heat because she's, you know, in charge, so to speak. So, you know, anytime someone makes the decision, the company makes the decision that or, you know, that the audience doesn't like, or that the fan base doesn't like, she's gonna take a little bit of heat for it. You know, Jesse's a weird situation, obviously, because he was injured performing for that company, and, you know, was promised certain things upon his return, and you know, and was given a backstage job and this and that while he recovered, and, you know, nothing lasts forever, I guess, and, you know, a lot of those promises didn't get fulfilled because of the business side of things. And so obviously, you know, Jesse's a very sympathetic person, and, you know, obviously everyone feels bad about his injury, so you know, she's going to take more heat for him probably than anybody else. But I think she's, you know, I think she takes a bad rap too, because people don't think she understands wrestling or gets wrestling. And, you know, people didn't understand that she's been doing this for 10 years, more than 10 years now. So she's got a grasp. She's got a good mind. She's a smart woman. She gets wrestling more than people give her credit for. You know, I feel like somebody has to point the finger somewhere. And even when decisions aren't being made by her, because she's the company figurehead, so to speak, that she's going to take a lot of the heat for it.
It's also kind of interesting too, not just in TNA, but anywhere in wrestling. You know, sometimes you'll hear Eric Bischoff or Dixie or there are all sorts of people that get very upset about what's reported on the internet or in newsletters or whatever. They get very upset about it, but at the same time, they won't actually answer any questions about what's going on. You know what I mean? So I think that she gets a lot of heat, but at the same time, she sometimes isn't open to explaining, okay, here's exactly what's going on, everybody. So now you don't have to write whatever you write. I don't know. It just seems like if you don't want to get heat on yourself for decisions, then it would seem that you would want to get some information out about why decisions were made.
That's true too. But I mean, you know as well as I do, a lot of things that get said on the internet get twisted or quotes get taken, you know, out of context and stuff like that. So maybe it's more of a defensive maneuver by her. Like I did an interview just the other day where, you know, I told a story about how when I ref the knockouts match, you know, we had to clear it with Spike TV about what exactly I could do hands on, so to speak, with the knockouts in the match. And then like somebody posted on the internet, like Joey Ryan, you know, says, you know, talks about Spike TV censoring the knockout. And like, wasn't about censoring. It was just like, I couldn't touch their boobs or their butts or whatever, you know, like it was just a very, I mean, you can't really do that on any TV show. So it wasn't about me talking about Spike TV censoring the knockouts or whatever, but that's the way that's the take they took from it. So, you know, it's just the way, you know, it is. If she goes out and does a bunch of interviews, answers all these questions, people are going to take pieces of these interviews out and twist her words or use them out of context and give her more heat. So it could potentially be just a defensive maneuver that she doesn't really do a whole lot of interviews.
Now, you mentioned Ring Ka King, and I have actually never seen an episode of that, but the impression I was given was that it was pretty popular. It only had one season, which kind of surprised me since it was apparently pretty popular. What are some of your memories of working for Ring Ka King?
Ring Ka King was awesome, to be honest. You know, we spent like a week, two times we went over for a week and just filmed everything. And we went once in December of, 2012, and then January of 2013, I think. And then, 11 and 12. You know, just getting to be in India and just being a different country and just kind of living there for a week and seeing everything. And then the audience, you know, who doesn't really get pro wrestling. I mean, they get WWE TV, like an edited version of it. And then maybe WWE goes over there on tours every once in a while, but they don't really see it all a lot. And they especially don't get to see it with, you know, guys that, you know, like local talent, you know, and Ring Ka King trained some, you know, Indian wrestlers and put them on TV. And so the crowd had like local favorites. So it was very much like the circus came to town for them. And they like, you would, you know, be on the shows and you would look out in the audience and see these looks on these people's faces. Like they could not believe what they were seeing. And obviously it was back to like the basics where like a hip toss would be a huge reaction. And it's what I imagine like wrestling in the 80s might've been like, you know, we're all just larger than life characters and just anything we do just is so impressive to these people that who don't get to see it very often. So it was very, very cool in that aspect. It's kind of just bringing pro wrestling to a new world.
Now the impression fans were given, and I think it was because TNA kind of announced that this was their thing, was that this was a TNA production. And obviously there were people from TNA, but it was also kind of weird because at the time of Ring Ka King, Jeff Jarrett, I don't think was involved in TNA at all, but he was obviously involved in this. And you also had Scott Steiner, who I think at the time was like involved in a lawsuit with TNA. And meanwhile, he's working Ring Ka King. What kind of crossover was there between TNA and this promotion? Did it feel like it was something completely separate? Did it feel like it was part of TNA? I mean, what impression did you get when you were working there?
I hadn't worked for TNA yet when I was doing that. So I obviously didn't see, like, I didn't know what it was like to work in TNA or the differences, but I think it was more, I don't think Ring Ka King was as much a TNA thing as it was a Jeff Jarrett thing, who just got, you know, permission from the company or, you know, finance from TNA as his own pet project. I mean, if you noticed, when the Ring Ka King came out, TNA never talked about it. They never pushed it. They never advertised it or anything like that. So I think it was very separate. You know, it was definitely Jeff Jarrett's brainchild, and you know him, and that was David Lagana at the time when he was before he got hired to TNA, and you know, they just, you know, I think they just had blessings from TNA more or less, or you know, like I said, finance from TNA, but it was very much its own separate entity.
Now they had a tournament to crown a champion, and if you look at the brackets, it's virtually all American wrestlers except for two guys. Actually, I don't know. I don't even know who Max B is, but Mahabali Vera I believe is how you pronounce it. Obviously, was one of the local guys, and he went all the way to the semifinals. How was he, I guess, as a worker? And you mentioned that obviously a lot of local guys had been trained for the promotion. Was there anybody that kind of stuck out as like, man, you know, this guy could actually be a pretty good pro wrestler if he stuck with it?
Yeah, there were a few of them. But the thing is, you know, they really only had about 3 months worth of training.
Sure.
Maybe 3 or 4 months worth of training. So they were super, super green. I mean, you definitely see potential like you can in any wrestling school or any kind of, you know, when you see a guy like walk in the door and, you know, he has a few months of training and it's just, oh yeah, this guy's kind of a natural. So there was a couple of guys in there that were naturals. But you know, a lot of the job of us Americans that went over there was to kind of carry them through matches and to, you know, make them look good and things like that. And that's probably why, you know, like the tournament, you know, there's only a couple of them in that and just, but, you know, just to make sure that those two that they put in the tournament or those two or three, whatever, would make sure that they got over. But, you know, there was a couple guys who, you know, had charisma. Maybe they didn't have the greatest wrestling ability, but they, you know, they knew. You know, a lot of them were actors of the area that, you know, or things like that that were comfortable in front of the camera. And then they took some, you know, because they looked at it as like, I'm going to be on a TV show, not I'm going to be a professional wrestler. I think a lot of them did. A couple of them were big wrestling fans and came in for that reason. But a lot of them were actors trying to just be on a TV show. But I don't know what's going on there. Obviously, I haven't been back. I don't know if anyone's continued their training or if there's any way for them to continue their training or if there's any promotions that are, you know, indie promotions that are, you know, up over there. I have no idea. But, I mean, definitely just like any other, like, wrestling store or town or whatever, you see a few guys that are naturals and, if you know, like, oh, they kind of get it. You know, if they keep going, they can really do this.
It's probably kind of a weird question, but I remember when I was little, and I'm sure a lot of people listening to this when they were very young, when you first watched wrestling and you didn't understand anything about it, it was hard, unless someone like really sucked, it was hard when you were first watching wrestling to determine if somebody was good or bad. They were just all wrestlers, you know? And
right.
Did you get the impression when you were doing Ring Ka King that even the really green guys, like the audience that you were performing in front of, couldn't really tell if anybody was good or bad? It was just kind of like they were entertained by the product.
Right. That's exactly it. Is that they, you know, they had no idea who's experienced and who's not experienced and who's good and bad. They were eating everything up, literally everything they ate up. And it was very much like, you know, the heels get booed and the babyface get cheered. And it's just, all you had to do was to be a heel was like, you know, very generic heel moves and just snarl at the crowd or whatever. Or, you know, I teamed with Nunzio or Little Guido there, and, you know, all we had to do was come out and, you know, he would do his, like, you know, his gestures and things like that and just very, very basic stuff and just getting booed, you know, relentlessly. And then, you know, the baby faces, a lot of local guys were baby faces. So, you know, they would come out and just, it was just so fun. It was just, you know, the crowd is just so, like, they don't have, like, an internet to go to run to read anything. They just, well, I mean, they do, but they don't really, you know, they're not going to know how to look up pro wrestling message boards or anything like that. So,
sure.
They were just having fun. It was just, and, like, it's such a good vibe in the room. You know, like, I've been in, like, PWG obviously has a great vibe in the room when you're wrestling there, but that's obviously in a very controlled 300, 400-seat place. This was like an actual arena and it was just packed. And, you know, I wrestled in big arenas too, and it's hard to get a vibe from the room because, you know, it's so big, but like this was just a, you know, big arena, and you just felt that everyone was just having fun and cheering and loving the product.
So how many days were you there during the filming?
We went 2 trips for 7 days each trip.
7 days each. So how was spending 7 days in India?
It was fine. We didn't do a whole lot of sightseeing or anything like that, because there were obviously production days and we would go to the arenas and be at the arenas all day. And then when we weren't at the arenas, we'd go and back to the hotel, and it was a very westernized hotel. You know, they had a couple of us ventured off a little ways, but we were like, you know, they were like, oh, don't venture too far away kind of thing, you know, like wink, wink, you know, don't get yourself in trouble. So we kind of all hung out near the hotel and, you know, it was very, like, it's a westernized hotel. They like made sure that they, you know, cooked westernized meals and stuff like that. And every meal we had was prepared by the hotel. So, it wasn't a whole lot of exploring, but just to get, just to drive through the cities and just see like the people and like, you know, it's so crowded, and you know, obviously, like a lot of it was dirty, and there's a lot of poverty there, and just to see that too, like firsthand, was just kind of you know, you get your blessings a little bit more when you come back home.
Now Scott Steiner went to the finals, lost to Matt Morgan, and Scott Steiner, obviously, a lot of fans have seen him on TV forever. And his character's, you know, very volatile, so to speak. But it would seem to me that Scott Steiner, you know, he's still doing this. I think he's nearing 50 or something like that. 51, actually. So he's getting up there in years. But it seems to me that that he would still kind of just be like a completely crazy guy. Is that kind of the how was hanging out for a week with Scott Steiner in India?
Yeah, he's definitely, he's a unique individual. Yeah, he's cool. He's down to earth. You know, you could talk to him. He's a little intimidating, obviously, because he has his reputation and his demeanor. You know, he's set in his ways, and you know, like he would be kind of to an extent, he would be a loner. But like, you know, we had like a you know, there was like next to the place we wrestled, there was a gym where we'd all work out at when we weren't shooting, and like, you know, he would obviously be there all day, every day, because you know, he obviously works out a lot, and you know, if you went over there with him, you know, he'd joke around and pal around with you. But you know, he's very routine. You know, he got up and did his thing, and kind of, but like, you know, he's very approachable, like I said. But you know, he's obviously, you know, you don't want to mess his routine up, because you know, then he might snap at you, because you always got that in your back of your head that, you know, that he has that potential. But he's fun. He's, you know, wrestlers are weird people in general, anyways. You know, like,
oh yeah,
not everyone gets publicized about it. Not everyone knows, but just in general, wrestling and wrestlers are pretty weird.
You got to be a little bit kind of weird to get into this.
Yeah.
did he have any outbursts, or did he save that for the ring?
Yeah, he pretty much saved it for the ring. I mean, he was cool with the boys. He hung out and drunk, and you know, we have drinks after the shows. And a couple times he hung out with us. Most of the time he'd just go back to the hotel and do his thing. You know, and he had his outbursts in the ring. You know, if he had outbursts outside the ring, it was because a meal wasn't prepared the way he wanted it to be. And he wasn't an outburst. It was just like his stubbornness, like, no, you have to cook this right, kind of thing, you know. So it's, I mean, he's not a jerk or anything. So he's not disrespectful to anybody, like, intentionally. But, you know, he definitely, he's quirky. Is that a good word to use?
Quirky would be a good word, yeah.
Yeah, so...
Now, also on the tour was Abyss, now obviously Joe Park, apparently, allegedly. Now, you got a chance to work Joe Park, I think at Lockdown, if I recall correctly. And he's a guy that he wrestled forever with a mask, and then he took off the mask to be Joe Park, and it's like he's astonishingly good playing the role of Joe Park. And it seems to me that he's pretty excited to be able to do something new in his career. Was that kind of the impression that you got?
Yeah, you know, he is really a true professional. Like, he's whatever, like, I feel like you can give any character any gimmick or anything that the company needs, the company wants, and he'll run with it. He'll make it good. He's one of those guys that's just like, yeah, just give me something to do and, you know, I'll make it good. Yeah, obviously, Abyss was very successful for him, and you know, and launched him obviously to mainstream wrestling. But I think he's kind of excited to do something that's so different than Abyss, you know, he's just having fun. You know, like Abyss character was a lot more probably wear and tear on his body, and a lot more, you know, difficult, not difficult, but just a lot more intense to do. And now he can just have fun and do silly things and just be ridiculous and over the top. And I mean, that's all any of us really want to do, is just be over the top and ridiculous.
When did you first grow the mustache?
The first time, you know, I used to wear a beard a lot, and the first time I cut it down to a mustache was for a PWG show in late 2005. And then, you know, just got over. And so I kind of kept it around a little bit and kind of played with it a little bit and changed it up and just different looks throughout the time, just to figure out what would work and how it would work.
Did you like have a beard? I think everybody who's ever had a beard has done this at some point. I know I have. Where you have a beard And then as you're shaving the beard off, you're like, I'm going to shave this into like a handlebar here just to see what it looks like on me. Was it kind of a situation like that? And then you were like, you know what? I'm going to keep this for the show tonight.
Yeah, it was actually very similar to that. It was very much just a whim. And then at the time, I was living with my parents, so I grabbed one of my dad's Hawaiian shirts and said, you know, I'm going to be Magnum P.I. tonight. That's literally how it happened. Is I was shaving for the show, just decided to leave the mustache, grabbed one of my dad's Hawaiian shirts and said, let's do this, you know?
And the rest is history.
The rest is history.
Now, Cody Rhodes has a mustache, not nearly as magnificent as yours. And I guess he was doing it as part of like a heel gimmick that he'd have this mustache. Everybody would make fun of it, largely because it sucked. But now, unfortunately for him and his wife, the mustache has gotten over to a degree. And so he kind of can't shave it. And he did an interview talking about how, goddamn, his girlfriend hates this mustache. But actually, no, now his wife, they just got married. And she hates the mustache, but now he's stuck with the mustache. Do you enjoy the mustache? I mean, do you feel that like, okay, I look good with this mustache. I don't mind going around in real life with this mustache. And now you're kind of stuck with it, or now you're kind of stuck with it, I guess is the question.
You know, it's good and bad. You know, it's obviously a great look for wrestling. It's terrible sometimes in real life, but
the idea of the mustache is that you're sleazy, right? But then you go to a bar and you've actually got a sleazy mustache.
Right. Or worse, you know, I go to a wedding or, you know, I go to church with my parents or something and I'm just sitting there and I just have this sleazy mustache. So,
and the old people just kind of look at you like, let's not get too close to this guy.
Right. So it's technically worse than going to a bar. I can handle going to a bar with a mustache. But the thing about wearing a mustache is not, the key is not how it looks on you or you know, how it's groomed. The key is just having confidence and being a guy who wears a mustache. And I think that confidence, if you walk around like, yeah, I have a mustache, and yeah, it's badass, then people are like, that's a badass mustache. So, you know, that took a little getting used to, that just to be able to walk around with a mustache and just know that you're wearing a mustache and be okay with it. So, and then, like I said, the confidence kind of plays through to real life.
Does the confidence come and go? Because I mean, let's say that you've got you wrestle in your underwear, essentially, as everyone always says, you wrestle in these tiny little trunks and such. And if you work out, you go into the ring wearing these trunks and you're like, I look good. But if you had to wear that exact same outfit in church, I can't imagine you having the same confidence that you would have in the ring. Is it the same way with the mustache? Like, you feel good some places, but in other places, it's impossible to walk around with confidence with this mustache?
Yeah, it's a little easier now because mustaches are kind of trendy now, so they're a little bit more in, and facial hair in general is in. When I first started doing them, like 2005, 2006, 2007, and I was having it, and like mustaches were just ridiculous and you know, silly or whatever. Like, that was a little bit more difficult to walk around with. But, yeah, you know, like, it definitely helped that, for some reason, the hipster trend is to have mustaches now or weird-looking facial hair. So so now it's a little bit easier because it's a little more common. But, yeah, I mean, just, you know, just with everything, you know, like, when I first started wrestling, I was really shy, and I had this really stupid gothic gimmick because I couldn't emote or show emotions when I wrestled. And then I just got comfortable with it, and I kind of just, you know, owned being what it is and what I'm doing. And then I obviously developed a character who's a lot more, you know, out there, a lot more open than a silly gothic character. So it's the same thing with the mustache. You know, it just takes time, and then you get used to it, and then you realize, you know, you got to work it. You can't let it work you.
All right, we got a couple of Twitter questions here. This person wants to know, any thoughts on your time in the embassy in ROH?
NBC was really fun. I really liked teaming with Eric Stevens. Again, it was one of those situations like for TNA when I was with Matt Morgan. Like, it's cool to be in this group and it's cool to be in this team, but I really, you know, really wish I had the opportunity to be on my own and do my own thing, because I think I could show what I really am capable of. And I didn't, just like in TNA, I really didn't get the opportunity to do that with Ring of Honor. I mean, I did a little bit. But then again, with budget cuts and my flight being from California is why Ring of Honor stopped using me, and it's why, you know, they don't use the Young Bucks all the time. It's because the California flights are so expensive, and that's you know why. That's more the reason why. But I would have loved to been able to do more single stuff there. And I mean, Nana's great, and you know, obviously cuts a great promo. But I didn't really need the promo guy, so you know, I've been like just be able to kind of go off on my own and do my own thing, like I would have in TNA. But I didn't really get an opportunity in either place, so. I really can't knock the work we did together with the embassy. Like I said, me and Eric Stevens, I thought we had some good chemistry as a team.
Have you ever considered moving out to the East Coast to get more regular bookings, or are you just kind of like a California guy and you're just not going to leave?
Well, yeah, that's kind of what it is. I mean, I was born and raised in Los Angeles, and you know, there's you know, which is strange in itself because everyone either moves here or moves away from here. But I don't know. I just, whether it's just my family being here or how nice the weather is all the time. Like, I hate the snow. Like, and anytime I have an East Coast booking and snowing, I'm just miserable. So I don't know if I'd ever want to live any place. So maybe Florida might be nice. A little similar climate, a little bit more humid there, but then I'd be away from my family. So,
and the risk of being smashed by like a hurricane.
Right. That's true. But I mean, I guess I got earthquakes out here, but you know, I think earthquakes are a little bit better than tornadoes or hurricanes because, like, you know, they just hit. You don't see them coming, and they're done. You know, like a tornado or a hurricane, you kind of like, all right, it's coming. Anytime now, it's coming. I know it's coming or whatever, you know. But, you know, like a week ahead of time, well, it's heading this way. And then you have to anticipate for it. I'd rather just an earthquake hit.
But, plus, the earthquakes aren't annual.
That's true.
So, West Coast it is, huh?
Yeah, pretty much. I'm a West Coast guy. I mean, like, it would help, definitely help my wrestling bookings to get out more, but, you know, I found, like, my indie bookings have picked up since I got released from TNA, and people aren't having so much of a problem now. I guess now that I have some TV exposure and I'm a little more recognizable of a name, it's a little easier to get the indie bookings to the East Coast, but, yeah, I think, I don't know if I'll ever live anywhere but Southern California.
Now, PWG, we're going to talk more about that in a second when we plug the show on Friday, but everybody loves PWG, and one of the cool things about the promotion is that, for example, Ring of Honor and Dragon Gate USA, the Young Bucks are the Dragon Gate USA tag team champions, and they ended up going and working for ROH, which kind of made Gabe Sapolsky upset because he put his tag titles on him. And you know, you kind of like, you've got this and that with these different promotions, but with PWG, it's like, no matter who you are, it seems like you can work here and everything is fine. How have you guys managed to have such an open door?
I think it's, you know, obviously there's no competition with like iPay-per-views. That might be part of it. I don't know. I don't even know if iPay-per-views are really a thing anymore. They kind of boomed last year and then, or this year, and then I haven't really heard anything about them since, but, that could be part of it. Distribution deals. I don't know. I honestly don't know. Maybe because it's so far away, like those, they run similar towns and they, or maybe it's just the heat between Gabe and Ring of Honor. But maybe that's simply it. It's just a personal thing between the two of them. But, PWG, I mean, it's not that we've never had to deal with politics or guys not wanting their champions to lose or things like that. But, for whatever reason, PWG has been able to be like an all-star fed where, you know, the best of all the companies come to work. And, you know, I don't know, maybe it's because we're not really promoters. We're just wrestlers ourselves that are putting on shows. You know, maybe because the people, like, you know, the wrestlers that come to PWG really like working there and they'll fight for it, or they'll at least speak up and say, hey, I really want to do this. And, you know, whatever it is, it's just, it's worked for 10 years now.
Have you guys ever considered iPay-per-views, or did the shows draw well enough and do fine with merchandise and DVDs and such that it's just kind of like, we're doing fine, everything's great, let's not, you know, I don't know if take this risk is the right term, but deal with the hassles of trying to get involved with iPay-per-view?
Well, you know, with iPay-per-view, we'd lose, like, Ring of Honor guys, right? Because they can't do that according to their contracts. And
yeah.
I don't know what other places have contracts that don't allow it. So, you know, they would also risk the quality of the show by doing IP reviews. But honestly, it's the game plan has worked since the beginning, just like DVDs and live gate and the distribution deal with High Spots. It's just all, you know, PWG's not a company that runs, you know, every month even anymore. They, you know, like PWG in like 2005, 2006, we were like bi-weekly shows, but now it's like 10 times a year, maybe. So it's, you know, the shows are a little bit more few and far between, but the quality, I think, is better now, you know, and I think people kind of, like, anticipated as being an all-star show and not really having to, like, book around contracts. And if you want to see your favorite Dragon Gate USA guy against your favorite Ring of Honor guy, this potentially could happen at PWG. So I think that's part of the fan base, too, is that, you know, there's no restrictions to who we can use. I mean, obviously, other than, like, WWE contracts or, I guess, TNA contracts now. But, yeah, I don't know. I think it kind of loses a little bit of its what it is. If we started doing a high pay-per-views or, you know, a TV show or anything like that.
Now, we don't have to get into deep detail or specifics, but just in general, PWG was founded by about six people. I think there are four owners. It seems like in any other business, if you had six founders and four owners, it would be just like an absolute complete disaster. But it doesn't seem like there is an absolute complete disaster with PWG. Maybe I just have no idea what's going on. But has it largely run smoothly with so many cooks in the kitchen, or have there been issues here and there?
I can't really think of any major issues that have happened. I think what's important with this is that we kind of we have he's not a boss because we're all equals or whatever, but we have a guy who makes the final decision. You know, like his say goes. So if I have an idea or if someone else has an idea, we pitch it to this one person. It isn't like I can't call, like, it's hard to explain. Like I can't rally you. Like, well, you know, four of us say yes, and so you two that say no. It's not like that. We kind of have, like, you know, on a much smaller scale, we have our own Vince McMahon who, like, well, at the end of the day, it's his say. You know, so I think that helped a lot. The fact that somebody we appointed somebody to be, like, looking out for what's best for the company, and you know, we all just kind of, like, you know, let him kind of control what happens and where it goes and the business end of things. And I think that really helps because, you know, then we're not all politicking against each other.
Now, we don't have to go into too many details as well, but when you guys first started with four owners, I mean, was it, okay, we're all going to chip in 25% to get the show going, and then we'll all take 25% of the profits? And I guess now you just have, like, one, you know, like a PWG bank account where all the money goes and use that for the funds? Or do you guys all still chip in? Or I guess any details that you don't mind revealing as to how this thing is run with all these owners?
Yeah, actually, I don't mind at all. There's actually six founders and six owners. And the very first PWG show, we all chipped in $500. And we ran with that. And we made enough money on that show to run a second show, and so on and so forth. And not one of us six has ever pitched in more than that initial $500 to run that very first show. And the way we kept it at is that we just booked ourselves to wrestle, and we paid ourselves as wrestlers instead of, like, percentage or cuts of the show.
Sure.
And so, like, obviously over 10 years, we've all made that $500 back just wrestling on the shows and just being, you know, a part of the shows. And so we've all made our initial investment back. And not one of us has ever put in a dime since. So it shows literally run based off of the profit from the previous shows.
You guys should be doing seminars on how to run a wrestling promotion, because most 99%, I would say, of promotions have not had this kind of success.
Right. I mean, it's, like I said, it's very simple. We didn't even know if we all pitched that initial $500, just, but this could be it. We could run one show and never see this $500 again. We all took that. I mean, it's not a huge risk, but it's still $500, and especially when we were all, you know, in our early 20s at that time. And and like you said, it just paid off. You know, like, we made enough to run the second show and the third show and the fourth show and so on. And 10 years later, here we are. And we never thought about, like, well, you know, like, since I'm doing this, I want more money for this. No, we just booked ourselves what a going rate would be for the time being. So, like, you know, the first few shows, we were just kind of making whatever local California indie guy would make. And then as our names got bigger, we all agreed to give ourselves whatever raise that we could command at that time in our wrestling career and things like that. So, you know, we just kept it very fair, and we didn't try to take more money off the back end or anything like that.
It's actually astonishing hearing this story of success.
Right. It's just,
we all got along, and nobody tried to screw anybody, and we're all wrestlers. It's, like, impossible.
right? Well, I mean, I think it's, yeah, I mean, luckily all six of us were pretty good friends and we didn't let the rest of, you know, the rest of it get in between. I know that sounds astonishing as well, but, you know, and then like, you know, there's only three of us really left. And, you know, so last year there was only two because I couldn't do PWG shows. And, you know, like, I think the first person to stop wrestling might have been Top Gun, and the second was Disco Machine, and then the third was Scott Lost. I mean, just exit. I mean, Excalibur stopped wrestling, and Super Dragon obviously stopped wrestling too, but they, you know, stayed with the company and did production side of things. But yeah, so now there's really only three of us, and the other guys, you know, they don't, those three guys, they don't even, they're not like, well, you know, I still get a cut because I put in whatever. No, it's like, if I'm not wrestling on the show, if I'm not doing anything in production, then I shouldn't get paid. And luckily, we've all just kind of done that. Because I think it's because we none of us really did, you know, how to put in that more than that initial 500. We've all made that back tenfold over the years of just wrestling. So I think none of us feel like we're owed anything by PWG either. We're all just kind of proud of the company.
Why Pro Wrestling Guerrilla?
Well, it was actually a quote from... Now, this is just because it's more than 10 years now, so my memory might be a little off. But... it was a quote from Gary Yap, I believe, who, oddly enough, was part of the inspiration to start Pro Wrestling Guerrilla, because we were, at the time in Southern California, it seemed like every couple of months there was like these guys that would come in with money and be like, oh, we're going to make, you know, we're going to put SoCal on the map, we're going to book these guys, this guy, and they would surround themselves by a bunch of yes men, and they really didn't know or understand wrestling. I mean, to Gary's credit, he kind of hung around and he understands wrestling a lot more now than he did back in 2002. But, you know, they would get taken advantage of by people who, you know, knew their experience in wrestling and this and that. And promotions would come up, run a few shows, two or three shows, and just kind of die off. And we were just all, we're just tired of dealing with promoters like that. So we just wanted to run our own show. And that was the initial reason for the first PWG show. And then Pro Wrestling Guerrilla, I think, was a quote that Gary Yap said where it's like he didn't understand when he first got into wrestling, when he first started Epic back in 2002 or 2001 or whenever it was, he didn't understand how guerrilla independent wrestling really was, you know. And so we're just like, okay, we'll use that.
So, and the rest is history.
Yeah, I don't know if anyone's ever told that story though. I don't know if we've ever divulged that secret of the naming of PWG. I've never been asked that question, so.
Yeah, well, it's a cool name and a cool logo to go along with it. So I was kind of just wondering about that. Well, the big anniversary show is Friday. You're making your big return to PWG, so I want to give you a chance to plug that and get everybody out to Southern California.
Yeah, it's PWG's 10. It's Friday, August 9th, obviously this Friday. A big stack show. I mean, ProWrestlingGuerrilla.com. You can see all the matches if you want. Luckily and thankfully, I'm in a six-man tag or six-person tag because I haven't wrestled more than 7 minutes in a year now. So it's probably not even 5 minutes since I've been in TNA. But yeah, I mean, it's just PWG is like one of those shows where you don't really have to, like, we could run a show and not advertise a single person on the show and probably still sell out because people understand the brand isn't going to have crappy wrestling, or, you know, the brand is going to bring quality wrestling and quality entertainment. So it's just very blessed that PWG has been so successful for 10 years, and I hope everyone can come out Friday and have a good time.
And your Twitter, the PWG Twitter, pretty much anything else you want to plug?
Yeah, my Twitter is at Joey Ryan Online. PWG's Twitter is at Official PWG. And then, you know, I'm on Facebook too if you want to search me. I'm probably the only Joey Ryan that's a wrestler on Facebook. And yeah, you know, I got YouTube, I got all the social media, Instagram. You can just look it up. It'll be there. But, yeah, that's about it.
The website, ProWrestlingGuerrilla.com, the 10th anniversary show, August 9th. There will be limited tickets available at the door. Also, BOLA, Battle of Los Angeles, which is always awesome, is August 30th and August 31st. Tickets are on sale, already on sale. Went on sale July 30th, so if you want to check that out, it's a two-day tournament, and it's I don't think there's ever been a bad one. You're going to see some of the best wrestling on the indies at BOLA 13 as well as 10. Check out at Joey Ryan Online on Twitter, at Official PWG. Facebook as well. And Joey, I want to thank you so much for doing the show today. Best of luck, and congratulations on 10 years.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
And of course, thanks everybody for listening. We shall talk to you again later on tonight.